Hi, I'm John Coe, and welcome to Icons of DC Area Real Estate, a one-on-one interview show highlighting the backgrounds and career trajectory of leading luminaries in the Washington, D.C. area real estate market. The purpose of the show is to highlight their backgrounds and their experiences and some interesting stories about their current business as well as their past, and to cite some things that you might take away, both from educational standpoint as well as lessons learned in the industry, and some amusing and sometimes interesting background stories. So I'm hoping that you will enjoy the show. Before I introduce my guest, I'd like to share that both this podcast and the community I started in 2021 called The Iconic Journey in CRE is now part of a new nonprofit organization with that same name. The new company will offer opportunities for sponsorship to grow the community both in membership and in programs. It also allows you as listeners to show your appreciation for this podcast, which has delivered episodes twice monthly since August 2019 with a charitable contribution. Transitioning the community and podcast into the nonprofit organization is underway. The community, which is open to commercial real estate professionals between the ages of 25 and 40 years old, is currently up to 65 members and growing. If you would like to learn more about either joining the community or contributing to the podcast, please reach out directly to me at john@coenterprises.com. Separately, my private company, Coenterprises, now will focus only on advisory work for early stage real estate firms and career counseling. If you have interest in learning more about its services, please review my website at coenterprises.com. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me for another episode of Icons of DC Area Real Estate. My guest for today's show is Jordan Goldstein. Jordan is the co-CEO of Gensler, the largest architectural firm in the world, with 53 offices and 6,500 employees. It's quite a large company that designs and coordinates architecture and other services related to design for its many, many clients around the world. So Jordan grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, in Rockville. Neither of his parents were in the design business, but he had a passion, as you'll learn, for Legos and structure and form. So he knew when he was real young that he wanted to become an architect. Went on to attend the University of Maryland undergraduate and then on to Penn graduate school in architecture, and started interviewing and decided that Gensler, because of its collaborative nature, was the best sort of firm to join. And he's now been there almost 30 years and now is co-CEO. So here are some of the highlights of our conversation today. He wants to talk about leading with purpose, a day in the life of Gensler. Design is an optimistic act, and he's very much of an optimist, as we talk about. The foundations of a design mindset, he talks about that. Bridging communities through design. The architecture of optimism, again, in urban revitalization. He talks about the pandemic perspectives and the future of design. He also talks about some of his wins, losses, and surprises, as I ask of all my guests, and some career reflections. And then, of course, my usual closing questions as well. So without further ado, please enjoy this wide-ranging and very incisive conversation with Jordan Goldstein. So Jordan Goldstein, welcome to Icons of DC Area Real Estate. Thank you for joining me today. So please tell me about your position and role at Gensler. What are your day-to-day activities and what initiatives are important to you today?
Well, thank you for having me, John.
You're welcome.
Great to be here. So I stepped into the co-CEO role of Gensler and started that. I was announced in late September and stepped into that role, you know, beginning of the year. So I've been at the company 28 years, and in those 28 years, I've had a chance to play different roles and opportunities to lead different aspects of our firm, which has been phenomenal. So in this perspective, it's an opportunity to work across our firm, work with all 53 offices or 6,500 people around the globe, and really look at the day-to-day operations and looking at what we are strategizing for this year, as well as looking towards the future. But at the same time, thinking about where this industry is going, you know, what's on the horizon, and how do we tack left or tack right to make sure that we're proactive towards it.
Mm-hmm. With that many offices in that many countries you're in, the diversity of situations, I guess, you're looking at from an architectural standpoint have to be almost infinite.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. You know, I just got back from a series of trips. I was in Germany, and I was able to visit our Munich office there and meet with clients and look at some projects we're working on. I was then in Miami. I go to San Francisco and Atlanta and India in the coming weeks. And I love getting to these different places because we're, you know, one, it's a cultural immersion, and we're seeing how we can really be, you know, the best of local and the best of global at the same time, but also really thinking about how we are able to, you know, play at, you know, across 33 different practice areas in the firm. So the scope and scale of projects is so different.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being able to, you know, look at emerging practices as well, which I find super exciting for us. You know, if you look at new practices like sports or health and wellness, and being able to work with some of the great talent we have in those practices and the opportunities they have to work on projects, which are, you know, the scale and the magnitude and the impact potential of those projects are significant.
Well, I want to get into the societal changes that we're seeing, not just from the pandemic, but other things that have happened and how that influences your practice. You know, it seems to me that we're going through a lot of sociological changes right now in the world and global trade issues and all kinds of things that are going on that
sure
have to have impact on architecture long term, I would think.
They do, you know, and it is interesting that when you look out at some of the challenges that are out there, you know, I'm a big believer that design is inherently an optimistic act. And I find working across the globe with our, you know, our teams that, you know, we are in these amazing opportunities. And they're not just, you know, on the projects, but also with our communities. So the opportunity to have, you know, social impact, to think differently about sustainability and what, you know, the footprint, the carbon reduction capability that we have through the projects. If you think about those 53 offices and all these different projects around the world, you know, it's a chance to make impact at scale and really be, you know, when we think about it, you really shape, you know, using, you know, the talent that is in this firm and really thinking about, you know, how we are designers of impact. To me, that is a phenomenal point, you know, when you think of the challenges that we have to be able to look at whether that is on the resilience, you know, issues that we're facing, some of the geopolitical challenges, and then even in our communities, the opportunity to do projects that can help, you know, unite and heal communities.
That's great. So let's pivot now.
Sure.
And tell us a little bit about your origins, youth, and the influences of your parents.
Well, my parents were tremendously influential in a number of ways. So my father, you know, was a lawyer. And my mom was a school teacher.
Okay.
So they were not in the design field.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, you know, once I got a little bit older and was trying to, you know, really figure out, okay, where did this interest in design come from? You know, and was there anyone in the family tree that had, you know, design and artistic focus? I actually found that my grandmother on my dad's side was very much into art. She was actually a fantastic artist. And then on my—
Did you know her?
I did. I was fortunate to know her. Yes. Mm-hmm. And she had, you know, in the time that I got to know her, she had like long since given up painting. And actually it wasn't until, you know, she passed that we were able to kind of find a portfolio of her work, and it's phenomenal. So in my house, I have, you know, tons of her work, you know, on the walls.
That's great.
Yeah. And then on the grandfather on my mother's side, and actually my uncle, are really accomplished. Well, you know, they were really accomplished statisticians. So my grandfather has passed, but my uncle still practices. He's a statistician at Carnegie Mellon. And so you get a little bit of that, you know, the math and the kind of the artistic side. But it wasn't really until my parents, I've wanted to be an architect since I was five. And it was
when a Lego person?
Yes. Okay. Love Legos. Yeah, yeah. Legos. I was all into Legos. And, you know, you could attribute some of my design influences to maybe Bauhaus or Cubism, but I think I'd attribute it to Legos. So it was when I was really young, my parents wanted to move out of the townhouse that we were in, and they were looking for houses. And my father was, you know, practicing law, you know, and at his firm during the day. And my mom, you know, when she wasn't, you know, doing teaching opportunities, she would take me around as a little kid and we would, you know, go look at these construction sites. And we would see houses under construction and, you know, there'd be floor plans and stuff. And she would come home and she'd want to give my dad a call and talk about the projects that, you know, the buildings that she was seeing, the houses. And she'd plop me down in front of a pile of Legos. So I just started, you know, building or trying to build what I had seen. And that really was the, you know, kind of the impetus to, you know, explore this world of design. But I give my parents a lot of credit. One year as a gift, a holiday gift, they gave me a drawing table. It wasn't your average gift. So, you know, they were really, I took that as a sign that they were saying, yeah, you know, go for it. Mm-hmm. And so from there, it was.
How old were you at the time? Do you remember?
Well, I was five when I definitely, you know, started to show an interest in design. I think the drawing table probably came, you know, something like that. Yeah.
And did you start diving into it?
Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, after school and after any extracurricular activities, when I probably should have been doing my homework, I was drawing floor plans and, you know, drawing sketches of, you know, new communities.
What was your inspiration for that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I grew up in Rockville, Maryland, and, you know, I didn't, you know, certainly, you know, coming down to DC, we'd come down to museums and stuff. You know, there was, you know, certainly precedent that I was able to see at an early age, but it wasn't that much. Mm-hmm. So I just think it was more, you know, exploring, you know, kind of just creative combustion in a positive way. And what it led to was really, you know, it just piqued the interest to the point where I looked at, you know, going through high school as just a way to get from kind of point A to point B. I wanted to get out and learn about design, and I wanted to get out in the world and practice architecture. And that's why I went, you know, I went straight through. I went undergrad architecture degree, grad architecture degree, and just went right to practice. I didn't take any time off between, you know, undergrad and grad.
Why not engineering? Why architecture, not engineering? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, you know, I loved that architecture, you know, in its pure form, it takes into account so much of, you know, different trains, different disciplines. I actually saw it from the beginning, you know, as an interdisciplinary career. So it combines a little bit of engineering, right? Yeah. It combines, you know, some of the things we think about from an art standpoint. You know, if you think about it from a landscape and site understanding, you know, certainly there's the, you know, kind of the understanding of geometry and thinking about, you know, volume and space and proportion. But it wasn't really until, you know, two moments in undergrad and grad that were really a catalyst for thinking about architecture at a totally different level. And I was just about to finish what I thought was finishing, I should say, my undergrad, you know, tenure as at the University of Maryland, and had a great experience there. And I remember a professor coming up and saying, you know, you're going to actually be a couple credits shy of graduation, and you'll need to take you can walk through the graduation ceremony, but you need to take a summer course. And you could take it here at College Park, but the same course is actually offered as a version in Rome, Italy. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to go to Rome. And so that was my first kind of foray into, you know, across the pond. And I had I was with a class, and I had an apartment near the Campo de Fiori in Rome. And the classroom was the streets of Rome.
Wow.
It wasn't a classroom. So every day we'd be out there and we would be drawing and we would be, you know, painting and looking at amazing, you know, moments in history and thinking about not just the history side of it, but what made it work. And there was one moment on that trip that I'll never forget. And it was, I was sitting out there sketching in a piazza and different day, different era. And I was sketching a plaza, in the plaza, but it was a palazzo facade. And two guys come up to me and they look at what I'm sketching and they say, you're an architecture student. I said, yes. And they said, this person's an architect. And the other one was his client. And they said, the architect guy says, do you mind if I see your sketchbook? So he takes my sketchbook and he takes the palazzo facade. And on top of it, he draws a musical staff. And he makes it such that the windows, the doors, and the articulation on that facade are the notes of the music.
Wow.
And I'm like, ah, okay.
Wow.
So then from there, I went straight to grad school.
Sounds like Leonardo da Vinci.
It was like one of those moments, yeah. Right? Where you're just like, oh, the music of architecture.
Right.
I can see it.
Right.
I can see in this case the
multidisciplinary.
Yeah. Gets back to it. Right. And it just weaves it kind of like all together at that moment. So I went straight to grad school at the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I chose the University of Pennsylvania was at the time they were really the only school in the country that was offering a Japan program. And I felt like I'd explored Western architecture philosophies and I really wanted to explore, Eastern. So I went to Japan. And Japan, the program there was phenomenal. You were studying with a Japanese master. So unlike the Rome program, which was very much, the classes in the streets and you're studying these, amazing pieces of architecture. In Japan, we were traveling around the country with this Japanese master who was teaching us the traditional ways of Japanese architecture.
Okay, stop there for a minute. What is the major distinctive factor about Japanese architecture compared to, say, the Romans? Because we're going back thousands of years in both cultures, right?
Yeah. And, well, there's some inherent ideas that started to, emerge in a compare contrast scenario.
Okay.
Certainly the permanence of Western architecture, like you see in Italy, these, the stone facades, the columns, the mass, the sheer mass and the weight and the beauty that's woven into that. In Japan, it feels very much like the architecture has almost an ephemeral quality. The wood framework, the shoji screens, the way light plays through, it's actually very light. It's touching the earth in a different way. And that was phenomenal to be able to see that at an early age.
What about the thought process when they were designing it? Was it thinking long-term in both cases? Or was it thinking, we're going to adapt, we continue to adapt?
Some of those temples have stood the test of time. What I found fascinating is we would go around and we'd study like traditional joinery. And, that's what makes it. So it makes it work, these things that were coming together and they're not using nails and glue or anything.
Right.
And it works. So that was an amazing juxtaposition, right? So I came back from it, just to add one more note to this, I came back from Japan back to Philadelphia and I was just like, my mind's kind of a little bit scrambled. You're seeing all these different, approaches to design. And I started doing a quick internship before going back into to finish the last year. And it was at a firm in Philly. And one day, the head of the firm walks through and he goes, we got a grant to work with the Zuni tribe in New Mexico, working with their old, historic Pueblo. We need somebody to go and be on the Pueblo and work with the tribe. And he looks over at me. He's like, you're good at building models. Why don't you go? So I was all of a sudden I'm out in New Mexico, not that long after I got back from Japan. Mm-hmm. And now I'm seeing, this Pueblo, historic, amazing construction, that is also stood the test of time. Different era, obviously, but fascinating to see that all. So that really whetted my appetite, for exploring international design. Being able to immerse in different cultures and different experiences. And that architecture, when you get down to it, it's really about creating platforms for experiences.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. So you went, was it 5 years at Maryland or was it four?
Four Maryland and then two at University of Pennsylvania.
Modern architecture undergraduates are 5 years now, aren't they?
There's different programs. You can do different tracks. You can do a 4+2 or a 5. 5 is a Bachelor of Architecture. 4+2, you can get a master's.
I see.
Or you could go and get a degree in something else and then go for, a graduate level master's degree, which is a 3-year program. Mm-hmm. And the reason why all of this is kind of coming, you know, right to the forefront of my mind is my daughter, my younger daughter, is applying right now to architecture and design schools. So, you know, you get a refresh of all the different tracks.
Is she aiming at Maryland or is she going to go?
It's one of the ones she's looking at. She's going through the whole process right now. The older daughter is studying theater at Northwestern. So we have both, you know, the arts in different ways.
I don't know if Northwestern has an architectural program.
They don't. Yeah.
I went to Michigan and I know they.
Oh, they have a great program. Yeah.
So 6 years there in education. And then what? Then what did you jump?
Well, I was looking at where to work. And it was interesting. I remember sitting in my, you know, my apartment in Philadelphia, and I was like, filling out, writing cover letters and putting portfolios together to send out to firms. And I was sending out to the firms. I wanted to come back to DC, the DC area, because, you know, my family's here and girlfriend, now wife, was here. I was getting recruited to go up to New York to work there. But when I was filling all that stuff up, I got a phone call from my girlfriend slash now wife, that she said, you really should look at this firm, Gensler. And she's like, I'm reading this, you know, U.S. News and World Report, you know, article, and it talks about how they have a really great, you know, intern program. And I'm like, oh, interesting. Okay. So I sent my, you know, stuff to Gensler. So when I came to D.C., I was between, you know, finishing up classes and graduation. I did a slew of interviews around here. And I came into Gensler and was interviewed here. And Diane Hoskins was actually one of the people that interviewed me when she was running the Washington, D.C. office. And it was a fascinating conversation. Because what I loved about it was that a lot of the firms I went to, the conversation was about a traditional path of, you know, design education, you know, in the professional realm. Mm-hmm. You're going to come in and you'll be able to do, you know, be working and supporting the team doing this. And you may move, you know, from doing that to doing this. Mm-hmm. And it was very much about like a process. Mm-hmm. And I came to Gensler and the conversation was about people. It was about culture. And design was like an undercurrent to it all. And that was like the glue holding it together. And I'm like, that's interesting. That's a different perspective. And I was still very fascinated by an interdisciplinary approach to design. And I was hearing more of that message here. And then the last piece of the puzzle was one of the ways I was supporting myself through grad school was working at the University of Pennsylvania's Architectural Archives, like unfolding drawings and cataloging drawings. And it's the work of masters. You know, Louis Kahn's archives are there. Corbusier's, some of his work is there. Scarpa, I mean, you name it. There's amazing stuff there. And I kept thinking about drawings, and I'm seeing them, and I came across some photos of these masters in their studios. And the thing that I always caught my eye was the master was in the foreground, and there were these people in the background.
Interesting.
Right? And that was the team, but you never really heard about the team. And I just kept getting this thing in my mind, and I find that this is very much true at Gensler, is that design is not a solo art. You know, really is, you know, an art where, you know, the voices of many, you know, in the right, you know, arrangement can create some really wonderful, rich solutions.
Well, it's interesting. Like writing, design to me is you're addressing a need to some extent, right? You're trying to get in the head of your audience to some extent because you're doing it for a purpose. The purpose usually is not just for your own need. It's for someone else's typically. In an architecture, you're serving a client, right?
Yeah.
Almost all the time. You know, you're not just doing it for your own edification. So, and as an author of a book, you're supposed to write something that people want to read, right?
When you think about it, it really comes down to, you know, you're using the power of design. We talk about this a lot at Gensler, you know. You know, the power of design to shape the future of cities, shape the future of experiences.
Right.
And, you know, that is, you know, that's a powerful statement when you think about it.
Well, it's a cultural statement, right? But your client might have a little different perspective and say, wait a minute, that's not what I want you to do. Right. I want you to do this. I said, well, this might be your role. Let's stand back for a minute. How does this all fit in?
Sure.
To its surroundings?
Yeah.
Let's think that through a little bit. Right?
To your point, how do you also look at these as true collaborations? You know, and I think, you know, that's something I feel like we do very well, which is not to come in and assume that there is a solution. You know, it's that, you know, the Adam Grant book, Think Again, mm-hmm. you know, approach the world from the, you know, the standpoint and view of as a scientist, you know, where
exactly.
you don't know the answer. There's a mm-hmm. question mark. Mm-hmm. And if we, you know, come into this and say, you know what, there isn't a prescribed solution. Let's figure this out together. What's the vision? What are the ideas? And that's the kind of ignition moment that is so like sets the journey, you know, on the path. Mm-hmm. And hopefully it's the right path, right? But it sets the journey on a path where it's like the ideas are flowing. And then, you know, I feel like as architects and designers, we have this wonderful role to be conductors of a symphony. And in the true collaborative sense, you know, the client is, you know, at the table. Also, there's other expertise that should be at the table, depending on the project type. You know, thinking about some of these amazing projects where, you know, we're dealing with, you know, complex sites. So it's unlocking the site, but, you know, let's get some fabulous landscape architecture talent at the table. You know, let's think about, you know, if you're thinking about some of the cultural projects, lighting design, you know, and how much that can play into this, right? Structural engineering, you know, being able to think through these days, you know, like on the Under Armour project we're doing in Baltimore, which is a net zero project, you know, having really talented structural engineers and mechanical, you know, engineers at the table so we can think through different ways. Like, let's get away from the conventional norm. Think about this is a net zero building. Mm-hmm. So just by the nature of what we're trying to do, we should throw to the side the old process.
Conventional.
Absolutely. You know, this thing has to work and perform at a different level. Mm-hmm. So let's just start fresh, whiteboard what this could be. I think we're going to get, you know, it's under construction now, just topped out, you know, last week, a very different type of building that I think for Under Armour's teammates, is what they call their employees, it's going to be a very different experience working there. They're creating performance apparel mm-hmm. in a performance building.
Interesting. So you decided to go with Gensler at the time.
I did, yes.
And talk about, you know, how you were told by the other firms you were going to do a certain kind
yeah.
of ladder. How did the ladder differ at Gensler in your mind?
Well, you know, it was the mid-1990s were an amazing time to be coming into this profession. And it was when firms were really starting to think about technology. And they were making the investment in computers and the software. And what I realized going to all these interviews is all these firms had invested in the technology. And there were computers at all the desks, mm-hmm. you know, but people really didn't know how to use them. And so I still had a lot to learn about the profession. But one of the things I'd specialized in in grad school at Penn was digital design. So, you know, had something to give as well. And when I came to Gensler,
interesting.
It was this wild time where, you know, it was like, what can you do with that new technology? So while I was learning about buildings coming, how buildings go together, I was able to help teach how we could think differently about the design process. And what I found, you know, the firm was a lot smaller then, but we still had multiple offices. I found other folks that were like me coming out of school that had a similar mixed skill set. Mm-hmm. So we banded together and created a group where our goal was to make Gensler a digital design firm. And if we were truly successful, our real goal should be our obsolescence. If we could get up to the firm to embrace digital design, which the firm did, then we no longer needed to be a special group on the side. Why? Because everyone would then
you
be
get mainstream. Man.
Right. And so here we are now at this point of inflection, you know, 28 years later, when there's another technological wave, it's going to be massive disruption, AI. And so I'm super excited by this. And I'm finding that people coming out of school, just like me 28 years ago, have had a chance to play in the sandbox. So it's a chance for us to actually have them, you know, inform a change process.
Have you done any collaboration with some of the big, you know, tech firms with regard to, you know, how can you help us use AI most effectively?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. You know, it's I will say it actually predates, you know, AI a little bit. So we have an amazing team in San Francisco that was doing NVIDIA's headquarters.
And it's
resulted, the buildings are built now and they're amazing. NVIDIA's headquarters is absolutely stunning. But it's, you know, it very much fits their brand. But during that design process, you know, the leadership of NVIDIA, you know, really challenged us in a good way to use their technology together with what we're doing to envision their space. So that the team was able to get in there long before a shovel hit the ground and start to imagine, you know, what it would be like. But not just like a rendering. It was like the actual daylight modeling and moving through the space as if it was built. Mm-hmm. And so now you look at AI and what we were doing and this is what has been phenomenal is because I think, you know, we have this talent spread around the globe is thinking differently about the process as how can we experiment with this? So how can we, you know, we call it the AI sandbox, and we have some design technologists, mm-hmm. that we're mixing in with design teams we're selecting some projects to experiment on, and we're just trying a totally different process. And the result is absolutely stunning. You know, what we're able to do and explore, and it's very much an iterative process. And I think a lot of people have started to think of AI as, you know, it kicks out great images. We're looking at it differently. We're saying, actually, what if it is actually integral to the creative process, iterative, right from the beginning all the way through, and it is transformational.
Wow. So basically what it does is accelerates the creative process a little bit then?
Exactly. Yeah, it accelerates it, and it starts to bring some opportunities for more decisions to happen upstream.
Okay.
Which I think ultimately will allow us to think differently about the other stages of the design.
Does it anticipate process. Challenges that you're going to have ahead as things unfold, basically?
It does. Yeah, it does. And if harnessed in a way that it is truly it's enhancing the toolbox that are available to architects and designers, then it allows, you know, questions to be asked and studied very, very early on. In a way that, you know, can really consolidate, you know, that front end of that process, which starts to say, okay, how do we use time differently? It's such a precious commodity.
Right.
You know, how do we use time differently? Mm-hmm. And we had a guy, by the way, that was transformational for us. It's a colleague named Joseph, came to us from Disney 8 years ago, Disney Imagineering, and he was leading design technology. So he was able to bring a lot of that thinking in, because what they were doing at an experiential level with new technologies, and we see it, you know, that comes out in some of the amazing
Pixar.
Yeah. And it brought it in. And, you know, even in the attractions and experiences to get in the parks, right? Like mm-hmm. the Star Wars land, he was involved in that. And you come out and you start, you know, to say, okay, some of those ways that the process was able to change there, could you change the, you know, conventional design process in a way that kind of reimagines how this could work, and it's actually worked out phenomenal.
Yeah, I think of the term reverse engineering.
Yeah,
when I think of looking at the future and what your ultimate goal is, and then how do we bring all that back to today and starting, you know, with the fresh ideas using that future technology there, you know, in essence.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think you said it well. Like we always at Gensler, we always try to look towards the, you know, future horizon there and say, okay, what does 2030 look like?
Mm-hmm.
So, but we started that process in 2020.
Right.
And ironically, we did the same thing we called it our Vision 2020. We did it in 2010. And it was interesting because you set some kind of big, hairy, audacious goals.
There you go.
Right. Yeah. And I think we also talk about them as SMART goals, you know, specific, mm-hmm. measurable, achievable with a realistic time frame, you know. And when we look at 2020, you know, the majority of those goals we set in 2010, we were able to achieve. And so we really challenged ourselves in 2020. Where's the industry going to be? You know, where's society going to be? How could we think about that power of design to really better the world?
So was this before or after the pandemic started?
Right during. Yeah. Literally right as the pandemic began. We were all sitting at our respective dining room tables. We said, we can't miss the opportunity. You know, we're forced out of the office, but we can still be together. And maybe now more than ever, we really need to think hard about the future.
Yeah, it was disruptive, and sometimes disruptive times, you know, you whiteboard that and say, this is different. Maybe we have to step back and think a little differently going forward, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, it's an opportunity to not only think differently, but also collaborate differently, right? And you would ask, you know, when I came here, so I came here and I was doing the, you know, 28 years ago, I was doing that, you know, kind of the mixed role, right, of, you know, digital design and also you know, very much involved in projects. So it was an opportunity to really grow, you know, and learn, you know, fast. And became a design director here and then started leading one of our studios. And then in 2008, had the opportunity with a business partner here to lead the DC office. And that was a phenomenal chance to really think about not just design, but what does it mean in this market? What does it mean for us in the Washington, DC metro area? And, you know, we grew, you know, certainly we had the challenging times of the 08, 09, crisis, but we grew. We got into different practices and, you know, became the largest, you know, most impactful firm, design firm in this marketplace, which was a phenomenal opportunity. Then passed the baton to take on the global roles.
So you're a Washington native, or at least Washington area native.
Yes.
So let's think first principles about Washington, D.C., because I want to get into where Washington, how Washington has evolved.
Yeah, sure.
And where do you think Washington should go? You know, we all know that Washington, D.C. was built for one purpose, basically, for the federal government on a swamp, basically. Why it was situated here? Because George Washington liked the site, I think. he surveyed up and down the C&O Canal here and, you know, and it was right up the river from where he lived, although he never served here. John Adams was the first president that served in Washington, D.C. historically. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting history there. So talk about, from a first principle standpoint, going to today about Washington, D.C., from a design standpoint, it was built to be the federal capital. All the buildings are monumental, at least in the mall in that area. The design thinking, as it evolved, and then how it's transformed over the years into, you know, a different kind of city than what it was originally.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We were talking earlier about, you know, the power of kind of the human experience. And you think about D.C. and scale. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whether you're down on the mall or you're on the other side of the river, say on the GW Parkway,
right.
Looking back,
right.
There's a sense of scale in this city that's really phenomenal. And it's a very human scale city. You know, the buildings with the height limit, you know, you go into the neighborhoods, mm-hmm. you know, and you get out of more of the federal core.
What do you mean by human scale? Talk about that.
Human scale, I think it's a, you know, whether you walk on K Street, like where we are sitting here today, you know, or you go down, you know, into DuPont Circle or Shaw or go over to Northeast or Capitol Hill, you know, there's a scale to the city that doesn't feel overwhelming. The buildings have a certain height.
Right.
The width of streets are, you know, there's kind of the major and minors, right?
So and you compare Chicago and New York
sure.
to Washington.
Yeah.
Different feeling altogether.
Different, yeah. And traveling globally, you'll go to a Shanghai and there's this kind of immenseness
right.
to that, you know, and you come back to D.C. or actually if you go to Paris and obviously with, you know, the origins of the D.C. plan where it has kind of that connected. Yeah,
plan.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
You know, you can get a feel for some of those cues. I think what excites us about being in this city is that, you know, that when we're doing, you know, projects that are repositioning an existing building, you know, or doing a new neighborhood like the Yards down by the ballpark, you know, we have to have that sense of scale in mind
mm-hmm.
and appreciate it. Because the way to unlock those sites is to really understand the surroundings, understand how that particular site plays in this urban fabric. Because it's not just about a site, especially here in DC. It's about its connectivity to the larger community around it. So like the Yards, I think, was a phenomenal opportunity because, you know, here it is on the riverfront, you know, on the Anacostia River. Everyone thinks about DC as a Potomac River, you know, but it's really a two river town, right? And it's there's this Navy Yard that has this amazing rich history where they were building ships in World War I and World War II. You know, and don't think of DC as an industrial city, but that was what was happening over there. And it's become this great neighborhood, like a neighborhood where people are, there's a park for people to play. There's a water's edge people can walk on. There's restaurants and, you know, and bars, and there's, you know, mix of retail as well as different types of residential.
Well, the adaptive reuse of some of the buildings there was fantastic.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, we love doing that. You know, being able to, you know, for us to get our hands on an old Boilermaker building.
Right.
You know, or an old lumber shed building and turn that into
residential.
Yeah. It, you know, or retail on the ground level, an office above. But what was interesting about that is because I remember, you know, doing projects in D.C., especially those that are touching, you know, kind of the historic corridors, you know, there's a whole series of regulatory that you have to go through, right?
Yeah.
And going through that, you know, a lot of people could think, oh my gosh, it's such a process. But it really causes an appreciation of the city and the scale and the architecture that's there, mm-hmm. you know, and what you're, you know, what you're adding to that. So the human scale back to that, I think, is really phenomenal about this city. But it really was, you know, for me as a native of the area, the Olympic bid that we did, that was one that I think unpacked a whole series of issues and opportunities, which we're seeing now play out. Like the master plan that was developed for that was not so much about what does the Olympics look like in D.C., we took the challenge that was given to us by the U.S. Olympic Committee, you know, and the bid process that was led by, you know, Russ Ramsey and Ted Leonsis and a crew of other, you know, public and private leaders in this area. And we said, essentially what they're asking is they're really looking for what's a master plan for the future of the city where the Olympics, you know, should it occur, could be a catalyst for that kind of development. And so we laid out this plan together with all the participating, you know, folks that were involved. And the first one did. That was before us. That was another Olympic bid that was done earlier. Mm. But this one, it was really around DC, the immediate DC metro area.
Okay.
And I remember there was a Washington Post article that came out after, you know, the Olympics were, you know, was decided they were going to be in LA. And it talked about how the plan that was drawn up for the Olympics shouldn't be lost. And how it really is a blueprint for the future of the city. And I was like, okay, well, that's interesting. So we've kept that in the back of our mind, and we've had these opportunities to play with these, you know, in these projects. So when you're doing a project like the Yards, or you're doing a, you know, a new building project or a renovation or reposition, it's thinking about how does it fit into the bigger puzzle.
So in my interviews with various leaders around the region, that plan has come up a couple of times.
Really?
And the context was interesting in that Amazon was attracted here because of some of the nature of that plan.
No kidding. Okay, I didn't know that. That's phenomenal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the people at JVG Smith and some of the planning area people from Northern Virginia, when they were trying to pitch Amazon on their proposal, use some of the storyline to attract.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. So, well, it's interesting you say that because one of the real wonderful things that came out of that process, and there were some amazing videos done at the time, was it's really a city of neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about human scale, but okay, well, what about the communities? And there's a whole series of neighborhoods. And at the same time, there are neighborhoods that are certainly thriving and there's neighborhoods that need help. And how could opportunities at scale, like in Olympics, or other opportunities that would come later, help create bridges, you know, that bring those neighborhoods, you know, and connect them into the rest of the community in a meaningful way that was really about betterment.
So over the last 10 years, cite in your mind what you think are the projects that have been bridges in your in not only in just in the city, but maybe in the region that you believe are that catalytic.
Yeah, sure,
catalytic
sure.
Projects.
Well, I think that there's a couple of things that I think are important. You know, part of this is the connective tissue that links these neighborhoods. So being able to, you know, look at the infrastructure improvements that have helped, you know, create the Anacostia connection across, right? So the bridge network that's been redone. Also creating an appreciation of the water's edge. So that's been done both public and private, right? Private development, you know, that helped, for instance, at the Yards, public park along, you know, the way mixed in with another development over by the ballpark. Right. And then go around to the wharf. So you really have a water's edge that is now, you know, I'll call it habitable. Right. You can walk on it. You can sit there and spend the day. You can live along it. And you really, I remember one of the early site visits down to, you know, to the Yards. And there was nothing. You know, it was, you know, abandoned industrial, and there was a lot of pollution. And I go down there now, and it's really a source of pride for what we were able to do, you know. But it wouldn't have happened, and none of this would have happened. And I think this was probably part of the power of the Olympic bid effort, was it brought together public and private sector for a common goal, you know, and that was powerful because it was no longer at that particular moment about DC, Maryland, Virginia.
Right.
It was, let's all be together and sit around the table and figure this stuff out. And some of those meetings were incredibly inspiring because it was looking at the future, not the past.
When was that unveiled, that plan? Do you remember? Is that what year?
It was like 2013 through 2015.
Okay. Yeah, that was right before the Amazon search, basically.
Yep. Yeah. There's a drawing I have on my wall that's one of the ones where it really reimagines, you know, it's a looking from the east side of the city, you know, out over past, you know, a little bit east of RFK, up above looking west. And you see all this stuff.
East Capitol Street, looking down that.
Looking down East Capitol, looking towards the monuments. But you see the Anacostia River, both sides of the riverbank.
Mm-hmm.
You see the PATH network. You see the bridge reference that I made earlier. You see the development all the way across to the Virginia side. And, I look at that, and there's a lot of pride when I see those images. Yes, we did not get the Olympics. Hopefully one day we will. But a lot of what was set out in there, to your point, has helped really re-energize aspects of this community.
Mm-hmm. So Gensler recently published the 8 trends shaping design in 2024.
Sure.
Perhaps highlight them and share your thoughts about them in context of the DC area markets with examples your firm has engendered.
Yeah, sure. So we have this wonderful publication, you know, where we put it out. And you know, we as a firm, we came up with the idea of design forecast several years ago when, you know, we had been putting out like annual reports.
Mm-hmm.
It was like annual reports are looking backwards.
Right.
Design forecast would be an idea. Let's look forward. So one of the things, you know, I'll give you a couple of the trends that we talk about. One is the notion of like 20-minute cities. It's the idea of, you know, bringing together, you know, within a radius, live, work, and play,
mm-hmm.
in a way that, you know, from the business community, they're plugging into the fabric that's there. There's a range of living options that allow people that would be working, you know, in that area to be able to also live in that area.
Why 20 minutes?
20 minutes was, you know, it's actually come out in so many different, funny, I remember when we started talking about it, it was coming out in different circles as well. It's walkable. Mm-hmm. It's achievable. From a transit scenario, you're not having to rely on some of the long commute, you know, where I say vehicles, but it could be different means of transit that push so much time on the individual.
So Jody McLean told me in her interview with
me. Yeah, Jody's fantastic. Yeah.
She says she looks for 17 to 18 minute increments,
yeah,
with regard to staying at the shop property. So she wants to keep her customers there, but she also wants to be within 17 minutes of most of her customers in her projects.
And you know, Jody, I think a perfect example of that is Union Market.
Right.
And we've had a wonderful opportunity to work with her and her team there. and also other developers there. And I would consider that a perfect example of this, you know. But also, I can remember the Union Market where my uncle had a warehouse down there.
Yeah.
And, you know, here it is now is a desired place to be going, whether you're going there to eat on a Saturday or to actually live or to, say, work at the Signal House building that we designed. You know, thanks. Yeah, it's great. Great project, but it was a different approach to, it had to fit into that community. Another one, you know, conversions. So resurrecting stranded assets. So that for us, you know, it was really, you know, a moment during the you know, kind of the end of the pandemic when we had a colleague in our Toronto office who was just looking at these opportunities to convert office that, you know, on, you know, underutilized office buildings into residential. And he was, you know, similarly to what I was talking about earlier, where we were rethinking the design process in the mid-90s. He was rethinking the process to study this stuff. He's like, why does it take so long in the marketplace for people to know whether this is right, this building is right or not? So he developed an algorithm that analyzed properties quickly. And it's not just about the building, but it's also about that building's location, you know, and its position in its community. And that was, you know, really was like spread like wildfire. And we all of a sudden were getting approached by, you know, developers that say, hey, I have a 50 building portfolio in these different cities. What buildings would be right for conversion to residential? And we could do this analysis very quickly and come back and say, oh, you know what? These 24 buildings would be right for it. And this is why. And that in a very consolidated timeframe, you know, and it's not, by the way, it's not just, you know, now we're seeing some real great projects emerge from this. It's not just about office to residential. It's also about, think about stranded assets in general, big box retail that become new experiential destinations.
Regional malls.
Yeah, or, yeah, right. And they become like, some of them, you know, we've turned into like amazing like health and wellness clinics, you know, or experiential or sport related.
Right.
You know, so stranded assets in general, the conversion opportunity, I think, is huge. The other thing, you know, design forecast we talk quite a bit about now is experience multipliers. You know, and thinking it's kind of the taking advantage of kind of the crisis stack and looking at experience multipliers and thinking about, you know, how people are really, you know, how people can interact with a place or a space. And if you do it in a way and you create these layers, there's opportunities to create a richness.
Dive into that a little deeper.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So think I'll use an example that we're seeing more frequently now with some of our sports clients who recognize that actually the value isn't just about the sports team. It's actually about the experiences that can be created, you know, in and around the venue. So how can that just be, not be, I should say, kind of the, you know, venue that's used, you know, periodically for a sports event? How can that really be, you know, an engine for a vibrant sports and entertainment mixed-use district? That's experience multipliers. So you certainly have a venue for, say, hockey or basketball, you know, or a venue for football or soccer. But all of a sudden now you have a whole vibrant, you know, surround that is, you know, entertainment beyond that could be live music mixed in, you know, think of the Wharf. It could be great restaurants and different venues with office and residential mixed in. Think of the Hub on the Causeway project that we did. If you think of TD Garden, that arena was basically just the arena that had a whole slew of transit issues in and around it and entry and exit issues. And so the Hub on Causeway was taking the land right around that, creating a new front door for that arena that linked together and solved some of the transit issues.
Interesting.
Created a vibrant, active ground plane, you know, with different types of venues, you know, in terms of restaurant and, you know, different types of experiential entertainment type zones and office above, and there's residential there as well. And now it's a great scene. That's an experience multiplier.
It seems to me what you're talking about is a hospitality mindset. So in essence, you know, you're looking at what is the customer experience? So when somebody comes to a place, what's in their mind?
Mm.
What do they want to experience? What what would be optimal for that customer?
So yeah.
reverse yeah. engineering that thought process to me is what you want to accomplish in real estate
in
general.
And do it in a way where you're creating a little bit more of a surprise and delight.
Exactly.
And when you can do that.
That's what a hotel operator wants.
Yeah. And then you think about what does that mean for beyond a singular engagement? It's people mm-hmm. that want to come back.
That's right.
Right? You know, I'll give you an example because I think you're absolutely right on hospitality. You know, hospitality infused into workplace, into residential. That's an experience multiplier. The Marriott headquarters, which we were designing.
Loved it.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. You know, it is, you know, plugging into an existing urban context, right? And there's a 12-story hotel that we did along, you know, mm-hmm. next to it is the 22-story, you know, new Marriott building where they put their offices in. But what they do every day is hospitality.
Of course.
So that space should just ooze hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one of the things I loved about their leadership that they committed to is that the ground floor and it was going to be very experiential for anybody. So there's a great public plaza. The restaurants and bars that are part of the hotel spill out to that. There's a cafe, coffee shop that's part of the headquarters building that spills out to that as well. And then there's this great opportunity to tell the Marriott story. So there's a cultural overlay too. You know, here's this amazing, you know, it's the largest hospitality brand in the world. And they're here. They're right in our back door and their backyard. And then there's this great place. So, you know, my favorite thing when we opened this was I remember going there just right before the grand opening. And there's all these people that were sitting outdoor dining mm-hmm. at the hotel because the hotel opened right before the main building. And there was a family. And the family happened to walk into the headquarters building. They didn't know that it was an office building. And they walked in because it's communal. You can walk through. And they walked into this area, which was kind of like this a passageway, which has this whole cultural wall that leads to this coffee shop, right?
I've seen it. Yeah.
And they were, their kids were sitting there like just, you know, immersed in this. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Right. And I was like, okay, well, that's something different. Right.
Yeah.
And all of that has to work together, you know, and I find that as a firm now, we're really having these opportunities across the board. So this could be in, you know, India, this could be, you know, in Tokyo or on the streets of London, where we get these opportunities to think about that. What does it mean to mix these practices together and layer these experiences in a way that thinks about architecture as more of a stage for powerful experiences?
So other opportunities in Washington that you're seeing in that respect, what are you seeing as far as those other elements?
Yeah, I think we're seeing it, you know, I would say in the sports and entertainment world for sure. You know, you mentioned in the Wharf, we're seeing it in the development, you know, around the ballpark, which we had a chance to do that master plan work ages ago, mm-hmm. long before any of those residential buildings were in. It was just the ballpark. And, you know, it's a wonderful feeling for us to go down there from anyone here and see how that's grown and know that, you know what, the master plan set out an idea mm-hmm. that you could have these experiences game day or not. And it could still be a wonderful place to be.
Well, the East End of Washington grew. I moved here in 1985.
Oh, wow.
Good. Okay. So, you know, if you went east of 14th Street in 1985, it was no man's land, basically, in Washington, D.C. And then what we saw was an assembly of sites in the office sector, you know, north of Mass and then down basically to, you know, the mall, going east. And one area that really blossomed right after the Financial Control Board kind of went away and Tony Williams became mayor was Gallery Place and that
sure.
whole area
yep.
there.
Yep.
And now we're looking at a potential change in that area due to the fact that the owner of the Wizards and the Capitals decided to want to move to Virginia, although that may not happen now with some of the financial issues, but who knows? But now there's a new vision being considered for that part of the city. What Is Gensler involved in that process, or is there any involvement in that? Or are you thinking about it for anybody else?
I think, you know, we look at, you know, the city as, and I, when I say city too, it's also, again, from those experiences that I mentioned earlier on, you know, it's Maryland, D.C., Virginia. Like we look at it as kind of like
the region,
you know, and, you know, for instance, I'll give you an example. You know, we've had a Baltimore office for years. Mm-hmm. Our Baltimore office is right next to the Inner Harbor.
Right.
You know, you certainly have seen what's happened to the Inner Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so now we have the opportunity to be really a lead voice in that master plan and that development of the Inner Harbor that will then stretch over towards the stadium.
Is David Bramble working with you?
Yes.
On that? Okay.
Yeah. And
I'm going to be interviewing him soon.
Oh, he's a phenomenal visionary. And I think that, you know, that's, we look at that as, okay, that's not just Baltimore. That's this whole area.
Right.
Right. And so success there really is an enabler for further connectivity in this area. So in DC, you know, there's going to be movement of, you know, different venues, different, you know, educational opportunities. I mean, look at the museum, right? You know, and how that's been repurposed. So being able to think about cities with a level of agility, you know, from a design standpoint, and knowing that when we have projects, there are opportunities to ask key questions early on. And one of my favorite questions that we've been asking a lot lately is when there's an existing building on the site, like one that was down at, you know, that was down at for us near the White House. And it was like, should we tear this down and build a new building, which was what was being asked of us? We're like, maybe not. Maybe it's a better sustainable story to not think about always building new.
Well, that opens up an interesting line of questioning that I want to maybe think about. And this is a vision I've had as a real estate person and thinking about the federal government's, you know, occupancy in the city is now sub 30% even. And there are large owned office buildings south of the mall, south of the Smithsonian. There's probably half a dozen buildings that are over 500,000 square feet down there that are probably less than 20%, if not 10% occupied during the day. So they're way underutilized. They're on federal land, so there's no tax income for the city from it. So my big idea there is to for the GSA to do a swap with the city for the land, put it back in the tax rolls, somehow pay for the demolition of those, basically turn over that land, either lease it back somehow and structure it, but open the door for a huge RFP opportunity there, similar to the wharf of the Anacostia Waterfront Commission, and redevelop everything from sea southwest down basically through L'Enfant Plaza in down towards the wharf, down probably from 3rd or 4th Street all the way over to, what is it, 12th, let's say? That whole swath, just redevelop that whole area. Can you redevelop those existing buildings? I don't know. So the question is, can you reuse those buildings? I'm not sure you can. The HUD building is perhaps one of the ugliest buildings I've ever seen in my life, other than the FBI building, which people think is even worse.
Yeah.
But, you know, those are brutalist designs that, you know, can you repurpose brutalist buildings?
We did one, actually.
Talk about it.
You know, where the MPA is, Motion Picture Association, you know, which is 16th and I.
Okay.
And that was a kind of the classic brutalist, you know, grid building.
Okay.
And it turned its back to the street at the ground level. And they, Motion Picture Association, you know, wanted to stay in the building, but they also wanted to make the building, you know, user friendly. And so what we looked at is, you know, it was actually a phenomenal study, because you talked about earlier about architecture being this kind of blend of different disciplines. Well, the building, the entire grid on the front was like a giant truss. So you can't go hacking away the structure, otherwise the building is going to come down. So how do you embrace that, you know, give it an overlay and a different way of thinking about how to break down that scale. And then where it meets the ground, how do we actually, where it was literally a sunken inset ground level that you couldn't even reach, to actually make, you know, two front doors to the building, one on 16th and one on I Street, and create a landscaping and site strategy and a new skin strategy down there that really just make this thing very accessible and inviting. And it worked. And you had to have people that were willing to play ball. You also had to have, going through, you know, the city, folks that were willing to, you know, say that, okay, well, actually, this can make this building a better contributor to the, that's urban fabric than what it was before. But to your, you know, to your point, there's all those buildings over there, and it does need some creative thinking. You know, frankly,
no question.
Where the wharf is, all that area was, it was federal.
Yeah.
So it was a triple P project that made that all work. That's right. So that's what we need, you know, potentially over here.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there is that question. I think it's an interesting one to think about, which is, you know, some of these buildings, you know, when we look at them, they may not pencil out. So are there ways to incentivize the development, you know, from a public financing side?
Well, my thought is if you convert that to private land, that's the way to do it. Because then you get private sector investment in the property.
Yeah, with, if you do it with federal incentives, even better. Yeah.
There you are. Yeah. So you clean up a mess and it's a win-win-win across the board.
Yeah.
It's going to take a tremendous amount of leadership and creative thinking.
And
the right people to meet with the right people. You have to get the White House involved. You have to get Congress involved. You have to get the city government involved. They all have to be on the same page and think through how this is going to create a lot of value for the city and for the federal government and the state, city government, everybody, and the region.
I mean, it has to be looked at holistically. And to your point, though, you know, there's a lot of, you know, these buildings that are not occupied to any level.
They're not functional either.
Yeah. And they're big buildings, right?
Yes.
They're big buildings. Yeah. I do think, though, that there is, that is, you know, for DC, there will continue to be that opportunity to reimagine.
Inevitably.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you spoke recently at the ULI Washington Future Forum about the future and espouse the phrase architecture of optimism. Perhaps elaborate on that theme and cite opportunities for urban planning that will excite real estate residents, workers, tourists, and just wanderers to the value of the built environment of the city.
Yeah, I really enjoyed doing that talk at ULI because I really have found through my work, you know, with colleagues here at Gensler that, you know, we've been playing in that, you know, in that world of optimism for a while. And to figure out how does it manifest itself in the built environment, I actually think is a phenomenal, you know, opportunity to kind of explore and think differently about how we look at design. So, you know, if you look at the definition of optimism, it's, you know, to be able to bring hopefulness and confidence about the future, right? And how do you do that in architecture? So, you know, I'll give you an example. I was in Miami last week, and we were having some meetings there. And one of the days we met, we used a space at a new school that we had worked on. It's a new 6th through 12th grade campus. And it was about a 5 to 6 acre site. And sites in Miami are getting harder and harder to find because it's one of the few growth markets, you know, around. And in that school, I remember when they first approached us to design this, right in the middle of the pandemic, when people weren't even in schools, right? And they said, we want to do this new school, privately funded new venture. We want parents to feel like they would want their kids to be here. We want it to be a need blind campus. And we want it to be something where the students, you know, feel that wherever they're going, wherever they're looking, if they're in the middle school and they look over to the high school, that's aspirational. They want to make it through middle school because they want to be in that building over there.
Mm.
right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the parents who drive up, they want their kids to be in there. So, how do you create that architecture of optimism? And I remember we looked at the site and we're looking at this amazing old tree that was at the center of the site. You had to get past all this, like, some of this overgrowth to see it. And I was like, wow, okay, that should be the heart of the campus. And so the campus, it really is a series of buildings that kind of work their way, they're oriented around this courtyard. And this courtyard becomes kind of this magical heart, beautiful softscape and hardscape. You know, there's outdoor classroom that's a part of it. There's all these outdoor eating areas that students just sit on the lawn. And the view corridors from one building to the next are all done. So the students sitting in the common area in the middle school, you know, when they look out that window, they're looking across that beautiful courtyard and they're seeing an enhanced, you know, multi-level common room in the high school.
Interesting.
Right? So the middle school feels like a high school. The high school feels like a college. And the common spaces, the dining areas, the spaces where the multi-purpose room that they gather, it feels like you could be in a food hall. And so to your earlier comment about hospitality, it's a chance to, start to think about that multiplier. How do we bring the best of our education talent, the best of our hospitality talent, master planning to the table? So everyone's pulling from their skill set to try to create something different. So back to that architecture of optimism, to me, that's an example of doing it. And it feels like the best projects these days aren't one-liners. They're multiple chapters of a book.
So is there a site in Washington that you would use as a centerpiece for something like that or that thought process?
Well, there's sites that I've certainly traveled around, as I've grown up in this city and the surrounding area, driven around many times, and I'll tell you a couple. One that I always look at and I'm like, I think about, for instance, the Kennedy Center to, east, towards 23rd Street. And you have all these highways that prevent you from getting from, GW's campus to the water. Why not look at going over that, right? Sinking some of the road work, create a new kind of western lawn, right, for that part of the city. The same thing is over, as you get towards, as East Capitol Street goes out and kind of crosses over. I've driven over that so many times. And that water's edge over there feels like it could be an amazing, series of path networks and parks that mix in, different types of venues.
Could you tie into the National Arboretum there? Or is that?
I actually think you could, because a lot of people don't even know that's there, yeah. Right? And you drive over, over in that way, and there's opportunities, that the communities there definitely deserve better, from a planning standpoint and from an architectural standpoint. So being able to stitch that together.
Take a redevelopment of the RFK environment to do that? I mean,
it would certainly help.
Yeah.
That's a key puzzle piece there. And that really goes to, the federal side earlier, rethinking what that federal, what that oversight should be, such that there is an opportunity for DC to explore different uses for that site. But it goes beyond that site, because if you go north and you go kind of wrap around, the rest of the Anacostia riverfront. And I remember, driving along that and walking along that. And it's like, there's possibilities here. Possibilities here. And it's not just about architecture and development. It's about public space.
Land use.
Yeah, basically. Land use. Restorative wetlands. There's significant chances there to do opportunities to do something better.
Well, do we have a Tony Williams / Andy Altman around to say, okay, this is how it's going to get done? That thought process where the big visioning kind of thought process that has to be at the scale of the city government or You're not going to get the federal people involved, I don't think, in that, unless NCPC is involved. But you're going to have somebody in a leadership role to instigate that, I would think. I don't know.
Yeah, I think you get, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be just one person, but it can be a couple of people that are willing to put their ideas out there in a way that, you know, they'll be, it may be rocky at first. But, you know, if we can all just kind of endure, that there's real potential. And I think, you know, we talk about that in the design forecast, which is really, you know, thinking about the challenges that are there today. They're also, if we can look at them, they're opportunities.
Certainly.
Right. And so from a design standpoint, back to, you know, the optimism is just recognizing that there are those opportunities. So how do we take some of those, you know, challenges and really make them the bright lights in challenge times?
Well, speaking of that challenge,
yeah,
your office is at the corner of 21st and K Street in downtown Washington. It is a given that the CBD needs revitalization. With your design sensitivities, assuming you were given a budget of $1 billion to make physical improvements to downtown Washington's infrastructure, what would you do?
Well, it isn't all just about architecture in the buildings. It's really thinking about what's happening on the streetscape outside,
exactly.
Right?
Yes.
You know, I look at, we have a project that we're doing with Avenue of the Arts in Philadelphia. So if you know Philadelphia, mm-hmm. urban planning, Broad Street,
right?
City Hall, all the way down south, you know, there's an opportunity there. You have, just like we do here in DC, there's some wonderful destinations.
Mm-hmm.
And those destinations are, you know, the streetscape that goes and leads to them and connects them is not really one that you feel very comfortable walking on. So we did a strategy and a design vision for the Avenue of the Arts, reimagining that to make it something that is walkable, that there's pause points, that there's vegetation.
Was this for the city of Philadelphia?
It was for the Avenue of the Arts group.
Okay.
That was then taken to the city.
Okay.
To get interest. And so we did the plan last year. And so it's just moving through that now. But what I loved about the sessions that we did for design, it wasn't us running off in a corner and designing. It was in these rooms where there's all these stakeholders at the table.
Is that equivalent to like a bid here in Washington? Or is it a little different type of group?
A little different. But there's similarities in the sense that, you know, that it's not just, it's the institutions that are,
okay.
you know, like the different venues, performance houses, et cetera, theaters, and it's developers. It's, you know, some of the, those from the kind of the public sector. Those were the people that were at the table. And what's great is also, if you think about the, you know, like I look at 21st and K reference, you know, the future of mobility, things are going to change. So we shouldn't be hard and fast and say that roadway has to stay the same. You know, with the rise of electrification, we did a phenomenal joint research project with BMW DesignWorks that's now out there in the public realm that looked at, you know, with the rise of electrification, you know, how do we think differently about our streets? And also what was separating cars, you know, and people, you know, and buildings, you know, doesn't necessarily need to have that same hard line anymore. It's a blurry line. So, you know, how do we take back more parts of the streets for people? And how do we think about, you know what, the building actually doesn't have to be, you know, parking, you know, on these levels and, you know, the occupied spaces up here. So I think there's opportunities with, like, you look at the 21st and K intersection to think differently about the streetscape. And then also think differently about that built environment edge. You know, if we start to think more about, you know, I saw some of our great urban planners, you know, master planners within Gensler have really talked about, you know, the qualities of an outdoor room. And some of these intersections, you know, are outdoor rooms, you know, and if you think about, you know, streetscape and, you know, with the streets in terms of the vehicular path, potentially getting compressed, you know, how could that change?
What about the use of parks in the city? I mean, Farragut, you know, Farragut Square, you know, the mall itself. I mean, all the, I mean, we have
the circles, Thomas Circle,
you know, DuPont Circle.
We have amazing parks.
Are they utilized appropriately at this point and could be utilized better?
Well, they definitely, so many of them could benefit from a rethink for the same reasons I mentioned, because mobility is changing and the way people are moving through spaces is going to be different. So you think about also the last mile, how many people are out there using scooters and bikes and, you know, how do you create safe places for walking versus those on that different, you know, on a two wheel or a one wheel versus a four wheel.
So getting back to the economics of the question that I asked, if you had $1 billion, what would you do with it? Where would you put most of your money?
I'd be thinking of ways that we can incentivize experimentation. So, and putting some coin in it as well. You know, not just the streetscape, but also the distressed assets that are, you know, along, you know, these big streets. So how do we experiment? You know, how does, you know, if that's not going to work as an office building converted to residential, what are some other uses that it could be?
I mean, you look at Pennsylvania Avenue, and it's probably the one of the least, even before the pandemic, was one of the least traveled streets because, you know what they did? They closed Pennsylvania Avenue between 17th and 14th Street in front of the White House.
Right.
When before that happened, and that goes back, I don't know, 20 years ago, it was a much different environment. So you just, there's a three block area in front of the White House, you close it. If you closed a section of K Street, let's say, what would that do? I mean, so is street closure is that an actual value creator or not?
It doesn't, it feels like, you know, like even with the Avenue of the Arts example that I mentioned, or even like the Hollywood, we've been working with the Hollywood, you know, in Hollywood Boulevard and Walk of Fame there and reimagining that with similar, you know, kind of big ideas on the table, future mobility, changing the, you know, potential streets, giving back more of the streets to people, you know, it says that all ideas should be on the table at this early stage, right? Why rule something out?
Right.
You know, I mean, I drove in today, I drove along Canal Road. And I, you know, now looked at like how do we think about that experience? You know, canal on the towpath. You know, is there ways to think about that area as, you know, kind of a finger park coming out of the city in a different way that it is now?
Mm-hmm.
Now people, you know, you're on the path or you're driving.
Right.
That's it.
Interesting. So I just finished reading The Power Broker by Robert Carroll about Robert Moses, who was considered by some the architect of New York infrastructure in the 20th century. He built more roads, bridges, parks, and large public structures than any other public official, perhaps in U.S. history. Yet he had significant blind spots regarding the market, the impacts of his projects, displacing over 500,000 people in some of his projects. I asked you before the interview, you said you had not read the book.
I haven't.
But the book that contrasts that style is Jane Jacobs' Death and the Life of the American Cities. I'm guessing you've read that book, right?
I think that was required reading in one of the classes, yes.
Right. Do you believe the cities are now more human scale and have completely evolved away from the grand schemes of the Moses that Moses espoused?
Yeah, it definitely feels like cities are increasingly about pedestrian experiences and how can we make them more, you know, streetscapes, more people-friendly.
Less auto-centric.
You know, it's interesting when we started working with BMW with their design, with DesignWorks, which is their, you know, more avant-garde design studio.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a phenomenal collaboration because they were recognizing the pain points. So they're, you know, they build cars, they design cars, and cities, a lot of cities don't want the cars in them, right? So what does their future look like? At the same time, we were looking at mobility and looking at that, you know, what does it mean in the built environment when all of a sudden the car doesn't need to be necessarily down in the lower levels, you know, wasting space. It could be, I could be using my car, electric car, I could be, you know, using that as an extension of my space. That's a really weird idea, but why not, right? So we started to think about what happens if you start to, you know, think differently about the cities, right? And you go to a city like Munich. I was in Munich 2 weeks ago, and I stayed at a hotel that was right down in the near the Marienplatz, and our office is right there as well. And I was like, wow, what an amazing, it's mostly a pedestrian core. And so people are walking all over throughout the day, crisscrossing. They're not worried about being hit by a car. There's bike lanes. You know, people are, you know, really owning the streets.
Is that a recent phenomenon in Munich, or has it been that way?
I think Marienplatz has been that way for a while, but they extended that out. Okay. And so I was able to walk blocks and blocks without worrying about a major artery, you know, in a major, you know, vehicular artery coming through. And I'm thinking, for our people that are working in Munich, what an amazing experience to be coming.
I've read that Barcelona is like that.
I was in Barcelona a year ago, and there's parts of Barcelona that are like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in Mexico City, you know, about a month ago, and, you know, visiting our office there. And there's parts of Mexico City that were phenomenal pedestrian experiences, you know. And it doesn't have to be, you know, over there.
Well, the mall in Washington is a phenomenal experience.
It's a phenomenal experience, right?
Right. Right.
Right.
But the connectivity is the question, right?
Right. Well, how do you do it in a way you're not creating islands?
Right.
Right. And like, so the mall is amazing once you're on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you still have, you know,
crossing Constitution Avenue.
That's exactly where I was going.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so, or Independence, right?
Right.
I mean, you got these big, you know, barriers. But to some of the principles we were talking about earlier of, you know, taking back some of the streets for people and thinking about that outdoor room and the scale and ways to, you know, look at how do I move and stitch across. There's some phenomenal opportunities.
Well, with the pandemic's impact on Washington, D.C., and the lack of people coming back to the city, isn't now the time to say, okay, it's time to shut some roads down and see what happens, which is obviously going to cause tumult in a lot of people's thought process. But at the same time, you might create value that you didn't have before. So how do you sell that idea of doing something on a radical nature?
Well, it does feel like there's opportunities to put up some trial balloons.
Okay.
Right. And try things out without saying it's a mandate. We're going switching from from this to that right away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then also just study patterns. I think one of the things I love about how we approach design is it's not just going about, you know, and saying, let's just get a program and start designing a solution. Let's design that building. Let's design that space. It's really thinking from an ethnographic, you know, perspective of like, what's the user experience going to be like? You know, how do you marry, you know, some of the goals that are out there? I mean, like, and watching people move. I remember we were working with Duke University years ago. And it was to do a study of one of their buildings. And rather than just start with the design and just jump right in, we had one of our team members just go and observe. Just observe how people were moving through the day. And then we created this really long, you know, like matrix. It was really kind of a graph. And it looked at the different spaces, how they were used during the day, and what we were hearing and observing from the people throughout that day.
Mm-hmm.
And what it did was it, when you step back and look at it, it clearly highlighted where the pain points of that building were. So what we said to them was, you know what, you don't need to actually renovate this entire building. You're going to get the highest and best use of your dollars by concentrating them here, here, and here.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it should be, because that's going to be where it's needed. So back to your thing, try pilots, you know, pilot projects, and being able to observe.
That's first principles thinking. Very good. You know, it's like I've heard this on path making. If you're at a college and you see, and you may not have a paved area, but you just look at where those paths are, and that's where you pave, because that's where people who already walk. They just do this naturally. It's a natural thing.
Right, exactly. Then you go back and make a path.
That's right.
Well, exactly. You had mentioned about the ULI talk that I had given, and you know we do this City Pulse survey.
Okay.
And so in our 2023 City Pulse survey, in our report that we did that gathered up the findings, we found that most people were going into the CBD of cities, you know, to think about shop, dining, socializing, or hanging out, So it's like, okay, well, if that's the case, you know, how do we look at it? Back to that Munich example, right? Well, what facilitates that? And so certainly architectural solutions, but there's also larger planning strategies that could work in. You know, if all of a sudden there are those plazas, those areas where people can congregate and feel safe, right? And feel that they can connect with others, or they can queue if it's coming into a venue.
Is there a large residential population right there and nearby, walking distance from there? Okay, yes. Well, that makes a difference as well.
Yeah, it's a mix. I mean, it's definitely the residential, but there's office. Like I said, our office is right there as well. You know, and one of the things I thought was interesting, and we see this in Paris too. We were actually seeing that we have an office near the Arc de Triomphe in Paris, and all these buildings that are, you would look at them and say, that's not right for office. What's happening? Offices in those buildings. Why? Because whether it's a law firm, a creative services firm, or whatever, they're wanting to be there. There's activity.
Mm-hmm.
There's life throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yes, you certainly could have an office out at La Défense, but being down at the center of that area feels different. You know, it feels more experiential. And, you know, with our research that we were putting out on the heels of the pandemic, we were, you know, posing that notion of how do you make office a destination, not an obligation? You know, and I think the Marriott project is an example of that. Exactly. That came up, right? Where people are going there because there's an array of amenities that create a totally different workplace environment.
A reason to be there.
A reason to be there and a reason to interact with others. And then there's that ground plane that I mentioned where people can be interacting, that whether they're there for Marriott or not, they can feel comfortable being there.
Mm-hmm. So you just talked about this, but I'm going to get into a little more. Looking at your business, how do you look at new opportunities? Because of your reputation, do developers seek you out for projects typically?
Yes, I would say both. We have developers and clients that seek us out, but we also have, you know, we have 70% of our business is repeat business.
Yeah.
It's just great client relationships. When Art Gensler, you know, founded the firm in 1965, he really focused on clients and really building lasting relationships. And that's one of the things that we are really proud of, is that clients that we're working with are, you know, longstanding clients. And, you know, the array of practices that we're in allow us to say, you know, we may have done an office building here for you, but over here you want to actually do a new multifamily building.
Mm-hmm.
Let's look at that together. You know, or, you know, it could be a consumer brand and we've done, you know, their headquarters, but we're also doing a new prototype retail space for them.
Mm-hmm. That's great. So Paul Graham is a software engineer and a venture capitalist who writes thoughtful essays. There are links to two of them. I gave them to you. One is called How to Get New Ideas, and the other one is called Taste for Makers. The first essay discusses the concepts of anomalies and fractals. Perhaps discuss those ideas and how they influence you, if they do. The second essay is a thorough explanation of taste in design and its influences. While this could be a course curriculum, perhaps cite your perspectives of the concepts outlined here, emphasizing your particular design philosophy.
You know, the first one that you mentioned around the, you know, the anomalies, the, you know, the fractals, the,
right.
It's interesting. I remember sitting in, you know, math class in high school, and I think it was calculus. And, you know, you get those equations and you create these great shapes on a graph.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a teacher saying, imagine that, you know, I'm looking at a 2D graph on a page, right? Or a 2D shape. You're like, imagine that that's 3D. What would that look like? And this is back in the day of, you know, paper on and pencil, right?
Yeah.
But I remember imagining those shapes as 3D volumes. And since I had been interested in design for so long and in the early days of Legos, It was actually very easy to kind of imagine that, you know, and that curve became, you know, what looked like a vase, right? And so I think there was something that was in the first essay that also connects in with the second, which is the notion of simplicity, mm-hmm. right? About just, right. you know, good design, appreciating simplicity. And I think for us, we have found that's one thing that we talk about a lot throughout the firm is like simplicity, right? Let's just step back and, you know, some of the best design work comes when you edit, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, to not be afraid to pare it back. More is not necessarily more.
Right.
Right.
Right. But that second essay gets into a lot of different aspects of taste. So how would you define good taste in architecture?
Mm. Mm. Well, you and I were talking at length about experiences.
Right.
And, you know, when we, you know, create a place or a space together with a client that prompts a positive, like an overwhelmingly positive experience out of someone or a reaction, mm-hmm. and they walk away or they walk by with a smile on their face, you know, whether that's a new office for Instagram or, you know, a new basketball arena in Texas, at the University of Texas, you know, that is... You know, you could equate taste to experience. And I find that when we get into those projects and we're able to deliver on those experiences, mm-hmm. it's hard not to associate good taste in that respect.
Interesting. So I think it's a perspective thing myself. I think that everyone has their own. I mean, some people like broccoli and other people don't. I mean, some people like, you know, eat meat. Some people like, you know, curvilinear shapes. Some people like more rigid. So to me, it's a personal thing. But what you're saying, based on the experience thing, I'm trying to interpret here, is it really depends on the client's needs and what they believe is good taste. And you're trying to kind of emulate that maybe, or... help them think it through and say, you know, you might want to think about it this way because I think it's going to work better for you in the long run from a practical standpoint. But also, if you step back and think about it, looking at it, don't you think it's something that works, you know, for you?
It definitely has to work. I liked your comment about the kind of personal nature of that because, you know, it is personal. There is a subjective nature to this. And actually, that's what I think is a phenomenal challenge. So let's say we're creating that new basketball arena. So it's called the Moody Center at the University of Texas. And I had a chance to tour it 2 months ago. And I walked in and immediately, like, when I think of arena, what would have been like a concourse that would have been cluttered with, like, you know, concession spaces mm-hmm. and bathrooms and whatever. I walked into an atrium. Mm-hmm. The natural light's flooding in. Mm-hmm. And there's a you know beautiful big glass wall and a big mm-hmm. plaza that I walked across to go in. Mm-hmm. And then the vertical circulation that's normally like, you know, kind of stacked or pushed off is celebrated. And I went upstairs, you know, and I'm like, you know what? This is fantastic. It was a phenomenal experience. And, you know, some days that's a concert in there. Some days that's a basketball game. Mm-hmm. And there's different places to watch those events. And I was talking to our team and they're like, well, we've been here for concerts and we've been here for basketball games. And I'm like, tell me, what are you observing? What are you seeing? Mm-hmm. And they talked about how the space is utilized differently. It has an agility built into it. And how the people's experiences, you know, for a concert are very different, positive, but very different than experience for a basketball game and how the space actually can transform for that. And I thought, well, that's really interesting because if you take what you're saying about taste, so how that person is experiencing, you know, that taste of that venue for mm-hmm. a concert, very different from basketball, right? And they're both walking away with a connectivity to that, right? And it's positive in both respects.
It's interesting.
But very different.
Yeah.
Right? That's an amazing opportunity for us to be able to play on that scale.
So what resonated with me with what you just said is that buildings are living things as well. So in essence, they adapt like living things do to their environment. So if the environment is different, for instance, a basketball game relative to a live rock concert, let's say, the feeling is completely different. So in essence, the building's adapted to that different environment.
Right. Yeah. And you know, it is fascinating when you think about not just is it buildings that can really be stages for life, you know, kind of stages for living, to think about how when we layer in, you know, sustainability strategies, biophilia as principles related to that into these spaces, how it's not only that, but it also it's ever changing in how light, you know, penetrates into the building, how people move through the building. You know, we were involved in an airport project in Jackson Hole. We do a lot of aviation work. It's a mass timber building. And I was reading a review of the building, and they talked about how this is an architectural critic, how they found the space so compelling and that it actually brought a sense of I think they used the word calm to their travel experience. Calm and travel experiences aren't usually,
very
harmonious, right?
No.
So I was like, wow, that's amazing, right? So to be able to do that, why in that case? So talked about the feeling of natural light coming through, the views of the mountains beyond, the warmth of the wood, right? The mix of the material palette. It's a simple palette they talked about, but yet it was very much tactile.
And this is an airport?
Yeah, it's an airport.
That's interesting.
Yeah, spaces that we don't often think about as, calm or that you're pausing. You want to move through them potentially as fast as you can, right?
That is interesting.
And I think it for us as a firm, it raises an interesting opportunity as we look at the built environment going forward, which is, how can the places and spaces that we're being asked to develop and create have, that flexibility built into them, that we can think about them from, a little bit more like to the essay about the timelessness, in inherent in the design. And how can you do that with a simple approach, simple palette, simple expressions, mm-hmm. right? Not to strive for greater complexity.
It's interesting that, looking at American history and then looking at European history, and then you talked about Eastern cultures. Did they design for infinity? Or did they design to get something built just for the immediate need and that's mm-hmm. it? And then 10 years from now, we're going to tear it and redown. Or something that's adaptable that had good bones to it that you could just readapt to. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. In the U.S., I think we've seen a lot of change over the years. This city seems to be as much of an eternal city as any other, like Paris is called, or maybe Rome. I don't know which one. Yeah. Rome is the eternal. Washington was built that way, but it somehow it just doesn't feel that way, and I don't know what that is. But anyway, that's just a comment.
Yeah, I think there's a uniqueness to Washington, D.C. and the metro area around us, right? Where it's, first of all, it's three different jurisdictions, right? There's the kind of natural pathways of the rivers that really define, opportunity as well as edges. And there's also a topographic condition that people often don't appreciate in the city. Mm-hmm. I know some of the projects that we've done in, for instance, in Virginia, where you're able to all of a sudden appreciate the vantage points of the city that often are overlooked. So at the same time, DC is a city that kind of seems like it reinvents itself.
Interesting.
Right? And it feels like now we're being asked that question.
Another one.
Yes.
So as a follow-on, how are you inspired creatively? Is this something that you can be taught, or is it innate in creative professionals?
Well, from a personal standpoint, I get inspired, you know, when I walk through our offices. I love it. I love visiting our offices around this firm, walking through, meeting people, and whether they're, you know, the seasoned vet or the new college grad, the skill sets that they bring to the table and learning about what makes them tick, I find, you know, like such a wonderful rush. But I love doing it at crossing cultures. Mm-hmm. You know, I find that increasingly we're becoming a very much a borderless firm. And we work on projects, you know, and connect one another, you know, across, you know, borders and geographies and cultures and climates in ways that few do. And it's absolutely, you know, inspiring and energizing to see that. For me personally, I also find that the creativity has to come and get nurtured from, you know, other avenues. I love guitar, so I, you know, occasionally make noise. I also really get, and I know a lot of people at Gensler do this as well because we travel so much, get inspired by looking at the world around us and bringing that to the table. And there's so many ways to do that now, to capture what inspires us, what excites us, and bring that in and layer that into projects. And that creates these layers of richness that I think can make that, you know, that particular project sing.
That's great. How do you hire new architects? What do you look for in budding architects?
Mm. We definitely look for people that want to collaborate, that can be really expressing the we versus I culture that we espouse. People that, you know, have an innate curiosity, because we really have this culture of curiosity here. And we embrace people that are coming in that are not wanting to just take their pen to paper and or mouse to screen and drive an idea. It's about putting your ideas in context with others and seeing what comes out of it.
What you said about the interview process coming here told me that this is a people-oriented firm, not a design-oriented firm.
It's a people-first culture, yeah, for sure.
And that guides your...
Yeah, and the other thing I think is, who, you know, people that want to continue to learn. Because mm-hmm. I've often looked at us as kind of like, I call it a campus in a box. Mm-hmm. All our offices have, you know, courses that are running through as a curriculum on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. These can be taught by people that have certain skill sets within the office. Yep. Or we bring in other people from outside that have that particular interest or skill set. Mm-hmm. And it creates a learning environment. But that learning environment doesn't always have to be formal. It can be informal. It can be the mentoring and coaching that goes on. I've been very fortunate in my career that I've had amazing mentors. And they've really tried to create instances for me to, you know, step out of the shadows and, you know, try something, see if I can succeed. And if there's challenges or if I don't, you know, constructive feedback that helps. And I think actually that's something that is really integral to our culture as a firm, is that, you know, coaching and mentoring and giving people opportunity. If I look back 28 years ago, I wouldn't have prescribed this career path. I couldn't have. But it's been a heck of a ride.
That's great. So how do you manage through the cycles in real estate with all the ups and downs that they have? How do you handle that aspect?
Through the diversification of our work. And that has helped. You know, we're fortunate, you and I, here to be sitting in Washington, D.C., which is a city that, because of, you know, the public sector work, the private sector work, the local work, the national work, the international opportunities, it is a city that, you know, through these different crisis moments in the past has been a bit insulated. The highs aren't necessarily the extreme highs that some cities get. The lows aren't necessarily the lows that some cities get. And we found that diversifying, which we did, you know, in the late 90s, really, really helped us. So to your comment about hospitality, phenomenal to all of a sudden say that, you know, as offices are getting challenged, let's bring that hospitality thinking in. And all of a sudden, the resultant workspaces are totally different. So that I find to be opportunistic for us.
That's great. So personally, what are your biggest wins, losses, and most surprising events in your career?
Well, I mentioned the Duke relationship early on. That Duke relationship, which started with that little feasibility study in Raleigh, ended up leading to a new campus in Shanghai, right outside of China. Actually, Kunshan, China, right outside of Shanghai. So we had the opportunity. I mean, when do you find an opportunity to do a campus, a full campus for a top university from scratch? So it's called Duke Kunshan University. So they partnered with a Chinese university, and we designed a whole campus, master plan, architecture, interiors. And I remember it was an amazing journey. I went back and forth to China so many times to work on this. And I, with a great team here and a great team there. And I remember going there shortly after it opened. And I didn't tell anybody that I was from Gensler. I just walked along the campus, back to that idea of just observing. Mm-hmm. Talked to faculty, met up with some students, walked through the buildings. And everyone had this look of they were a pride of place, that they were like they were happy there. The outdoor spaces were phenomenal. The indoor spaces looked out and embraced the outdoor spaces. And I remember vividly walking into the into one of the common spaces, and there's these paintings tacked to the wall. And I found someone that worked in that building. I said, who did these paintings? And they said, well, it's actually the school children from the nearby elementary school. And it's paintings of special moments on that campus.
Interesting.
That those little kids walked on that campus and that they were inspired by that. So that's a project that I think of as a great success. Certainly the Shanghai Tower, which we did, as like you think of it, so second tallest building in the world, largest building in Asia, was a phenomenal experiment. That was like reinventing the super tall tower. What is a skyscraper want to be in the future? And that was an incredible success story. You know, I mentioned challenges. You know, the Olympics that we didn't get. Well, we didn't get it. But out of that came ideas that could really seed, you know, future thinking. And I think we are believers that, you know, in the opportunities that are successful, phenomenal. But in the moments when it isn't, there are certainly kernels that can be captured that are learnings that can benefit us going forward.
Any surprises, anything that kind of came out of left field that you didn't expect?
Yeah, I mean, I'll talk one right now, the growth of our sports practice. It's unbelievable. We started this 15 years ago, and we really have centers of excellence in Austin, D.C., and L.A. Mm-hmm. But these sports opportunities, collegiate and pro, are happening globally. And they are at all different scales. It could be a basketball performance center for college teams. It could be a new stadium for a soccer team in L.A. It could be a new, you know, basketball arena. It could be a new football stadium. They're coming in a way that's like, wow. And all of them that are, you know, the bigger pro venues, whether they're renovations or new venues, are really thinking about not just the venue. Back to that earlier dialogue about sports and entertainment districts. And that's great. So think of all the practice area leadership that can play at that table. So that's been a really pleasant surprise. So because of that, this week we're actually opening a Kansas City location. Because it's a talent hub for sports. And we're finding that there's a lot of interest in our sports practice because it's very different than the other sports practices that are out there. So people first attitude. It's about these practices all weaving together to create that multiplier.
Well, that city had success last evening.
Sure did. It's going to be a heck of a parade on Wednesday.
I'm sure. And they have an, I've been there a few times, and one of the coolest architectural setups I've ever seen is Country Club Plaza there, which is a 1940s shopping area, which is really interesting, the history of that. I don't know if you've seen it or not. But
images, yeah. Yeah, and the space we're opening up in is, it's like quintessential Kansas City, like old warehouse.
Oh, really?
Yeah, kind of stuff. Cool. And it's like, that's feels right.
That's cool. So what is your life philosophy with business, family, and giving back to the community?
So very fortunate that I married a woman that I've known since nursery school.
Wow.
And whose last name was the same as mine before we got married.
Oh my goodness.
She was a Goldstein before she was a Goldstein. And, you know, we have two great, great daughters. But just as my parents, you know, did with me, which is, you know, encourage exploration and really feed the passions, I feel like we're trying to do that as well. And we, our family is largely in this area, which is great. So it's not just about architecture and design in the city, but it's recognizing that it's architecture and design in a city that our families and our extended, you know, family all live in this area too. So it's bettering the communities for them as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from a, you know, a standpoint of giving back, a couple of things. I love the academic environment. And I know several of my colleagues at Gensler here have been involved in teaching for a while. So, you know, in, you know, shortly after the murder of George Floyd, we recognized that maybe we should think about teaching in a different way and connecting and building a bridge to the next generation. And perhaps really thinking that, you know what, diversity in this profession needs to be looked at through a much harder lens. So we created a program. We went to the 7 HBCUs that have accredited design programs.
Oh, that's great.
And said, hey, can we be in the classroom with you? So we're on our fourth year of doing this. And it is, you know, we are in the classroom with them. And we call it a mentor program. So we have over 50 Gensler leaders that are in the classroom working with faculty, you know, teaching studio classes and creating a bridge for those, for several students to come and work, but also for ideas to be shared, you know, back and forth.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is Howard one of them?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So that's your local one here.
Howard, UDC.
Oh, that's right.
Morgan State.
Okay.
Outside of Baltimore. So three, you know, right in this area. Mm-hmm. And then giving back is also not just about, you know, our core here. It's also about really challenging ideas that are out there. So we did a study with the city, for instance, that looked at how could you claim back some of those areas of the road that we were talking about earlier and create parklet spaces. And that led to drawings and guidelines for how to think differently about the streetscapes.
Mm-hmm. That's cool. So what advice would you give your 25-year-old self today?
I would say to embrace the off-ramps. So the career path and the journey, you're on this highway and there will be off-ramps.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, you know, I've been fortunate, Diane Hoskins and Andy Cohen that have been the CEOs for 18 years prior to stepping into this role for me are now our global chairs. They both were really early mentors and encouraged, you know what, if you see an off-ramp that's interesting, you know, and you're not sure where it could lead, take it. And so that's led to a lot of opportunities. So I would say, don't be afraid of those off-ramps. And at the same time, they're not going to all be successful.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't succeed, that's okay. Learn from it. Just keep going. Focus forward. And as I tell my kids, don't live life in the rearview mirror.
Right. Keep going.
Keep going.
There you go. If you could post a statement on a billboard on the Capitol Beltway for millions to see, what would it say?
Don't look, keep driving. I would say, you know, actually it would go back to focus forward. Because it feels like there's a bright future for all those in our, in, you know, the architectural and design profession. It's going to change. There's going to be disruption, but it's going to lead to something very different and opportunistic for so many people.
Jordan Goldstein, thank you for joining me.
John, a pleasure. Great dialogue. Great. And
thank
good
you
being with you.
Enjoyed it.